As the silent seconds dance in their eternity about me and set aflame again the fire to inspire my nimble fingers to procure the pen and awaken it in a resurrection, transforming the ink to the blood of the writer. As once again he bleeds his acquired wisdom like a light into the world.
Good morning, Cabro and the Big Chill. This is Claudio of Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else, here in the studio with John Paul. Say hello to the people, John Paul.
The people, John Paul.
And we have the distinct pleasure, the honor of having what I would consider a North Carolina legend in the studio with us today.
Well, you're not the only one who considers that.
I wouldn't think so. Yes. Mr. Ira David Wood III is here in the studio.
Yay! Good to be here. Thank
welcome,
you.
Welcome.
We're going to delve into the arts and politics, so this could be a rather shady speakeasy as far as some of the things we'll pry into.
Put on your seatbelt.
Indeed. Once it gets rolling, it's going to be a roller coaster. Yeah. I want to go ahead and mention big thanks to my underwriters right from the start so that I don't forget to do it later in the show. And that, of course, would be Carolina Theatre of Durham, the historic Carolina Theatre. Just want to give you a big thanks and big heads up. I don't really have the rundown of what's playing there right now. I haven't been there in a little while, but I shall get that message to you guys next time. However, just big thanks to the Carolina Theatre, as well as Studio in the Woods, Inc. with John Demers. They're bringing out the film Will to Power, which I'll be hosting on the 17th, the initial screening. I've yet to find out exactly where that's going to be. But
hi, John. Don't be a stranger.
Actually, John Demers will be on here next week. Hopefully, yes. If you're listening, that's when you're scheduled.
We can only hope.
And the movie is Will to Power, and you can look it up on computer, Will to Power, the movie. I think I also want to mention the Acoustic Fest, the WCOM benefit that's coming up live at the Cave on Saturday, October 11th, 7:30 p.m., which will be featuring Shannon O'Connor, John Howie Jr., with Nathan Golub, The Watercallers, Harmonica Bob, and Near Blind James. That's who's going to be jamming there on behalf of WCOM. I also think that WCOM is at this point looking for a new location, so if anybody has any ideas what rooftop we can bellow from, please let us know.
We need digs.
Yes, man. Anything you can pass our way. Also want to give an announce for the upcoming West End Poets Weekend coming up at the Carborough Century Center.
Which we will not be doing this year. Next year we may.
We had too many things going on. I may try to drop in, but I can't make any promises. They did ask me to hang a 16-piece art gallery over there, which I was very honored to do. So that'll be there instead of us this year.
Yes, as you go into the office area, all you wonderful listeners, you turn right in the main door and you'll see Claudio's pictures and paintings and so forth hanging on the walls.
And feel free to support your local broke artist by purchasing anything you see.
Was that a blatant commercial appeal?
It actually was. And I was also recently informed by Valerie, Valerie and Carl, who have a gallery in Durham, the Artful Greetings Gallery, in which many of my pieces are hung, that they have actually transferred quite a few of my pieces over to Duke University as well as Duke Hospital. So I'm very honored and very impressed that they accomplished that. So, hello, Artful Greetings. They were on here last week, wasn't it?
Was it? Yes.
Yes. Everything seems so far away when you do the show once a week.
Things get rather murky after a while.
Yes. But anyway, so I think I've covered all the bases there. Has anyone I've forgotten? Just want to make sure I give a heads up to everybody right at the heads up of the show.
Well, people can go to claudioarts.com if they want to and look at your website.
That's true. And I also want to give a heads up to ArtSync Magazine.
ArtSync Magazine, yes.
Who has actually created a link to my website on theirs as well as created their own.
Have you reciprocated?
No. I haven't made a link there yet. We'll find out where those bridges are built later. But
we'll have to get the webmaster on that one.
Nonetheless, I want to give a big heads up. I'm told that they've listened to all but five of our radio shows, so we haven't gotten in trouble yet, strangely
enough. They're still listening?
They're still listening.
I'll be darned.
Go figure.
That's amazing.
Anyway, hello to you folks, and particularly hello to Christine and Linda, and thanks for all the good work. Now that we're going back to the speakeasy, I'd like to introduce our guest today, Monsieur Ira David Wood III of
bonjour,
Theatre.
Bonjour.
Bonjour. Of Theatre in the Park and other extraordinary. Is that mic hanging right there for you?
Yes, sir.
Feels okay, good. We've got them all lined up. I thought we might just start out with the most recent artistic endeavor since Christmas Carol. As a matter of fact, want to toot the horn on your behalf on Christmas Carol, the fact that you guys made a clear million this time.
Yes,
which
the
was
best
just
year.
Extraordinary. Wow.
Not bad for a week.
Not bad at all.
A little community theater in Raleigh, yeah.
Yeah, Papa needed some
Not
new shoes.
Not bad at all, and he yes. got them.
He's got them.
And didn't you go to France?
We're going to France next year.
Oh, it's next year. Okay,
yeah,
okay.
We went 20 years ago, so next year will be the 20th anniversary of the
sister city.
Tour.
Is it Compiègne?
Compiègne.
Compiègne. Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Wonderful. What inspired that? And I know you and I have talked about this before, but what actually qualifies it as a sister city? It's obviously not the same name. What is it about the geography or about the atmosphere, the place?
I think it's just the organization, the sister city organization. They will identify a city, or a city will say, we're interested in twinning with Raleigh.
Oh, we like you.
Yes, exactly.
Good.
And that's
okay.
the way it starts.
Just like a relationship.
It's exactly.
Go over and see the Frenchies.
Well, I wanted to mention also the monologue that David did after Christmas that we went to see last year, which
Truman Capote.
I enjoyed tremendously, yes.
Christmas memory.
Yeah,
yes.
Which was, I thought, absolutely fabulous. I truly enjoyed that. And it was really a lot of fun to be able to come out of the audience after the proverbial curtain came down and stand on the stage and just look around and see the real photographs of Capote and his aunt, right?
That's right. It's actually a cousin.
It just gave me it's like the hair on the back of my neck.
It's such an amazingly human story.
Yeah, it was really great.
I think if everybody in the audience actually gave themselves the freedom to express what they felt in response to David's performance and the work itself, I mean, Truman Capote's certainly, the audience would be sobbing and not just choking up, because it's really that emotional a piece.
It is. Someone gave it to me 30 years ago, and on Christmas Day afternoon, I finally picked it up and read it. I was stretched out on the sofa, and I couldn't get up. It hits every heartstring you have.
It does.
It doesn't miss one. He puts a verb behind the noun that just does it.
It really
and
does.
I knew when I read it, I wanted to do it as a one-man show, and I had friends in New York who got his telephone number for me, and he was in the Hamptons, and I called him.
And he answered the phone, and he heard that wonderful little Truman voice.
And I told him, I introduced myself, and I said, I want to do a Christmas memory as a one-man show.
Well, do you want to rewrite it?
I said, no, sir. I want to do it exactly the way you wrote it. And I explained my concept for the production. And he was delighted.
Well, nothing could be more pleasing to an author to hear that you want to do what he's got.
Yeah, yes. And it worked so well because it's written in first person.
Absolutely.
And it's just incredible as a performance.
Well, you speak to the audience and you put the people on the stage. I think that's a compliment, not so much to me, but to what he wrote, is that people will come back later and say, I saw her on the stage.
Absolutely.
She was there. The dog
it's right. It was just amazing.
The great thing was, I told him, I said, I certainly want to work out a royalty, to pay you something for permission to do the show. He said, oh, no, you take it. Do it. I wish you luck with it. Let me know how it goes. So I communicated with him after, told him what a success it had been. He died a few years later, and I got in touch with the publishers, and I said, I still would like to do a Christmas memory.
Who do I see for permission, right?
And they said, you have permission. He's left permission, and you don't have to pay anything.
Really,
it's yours, and you do it. And I think he granted permission to one other person.
Uh-huh.
So very honored and very fortunate, but it's a Christmas gift to myself.
Incredible.
I go off stage, and I go up to the tech booth and watch John Paul, those people that go up on the stage, because I think that's a wonderful gift.
Then you saw me standing around, even though you didn't know it was me.
Right.
I just really enjoyed being on that stage after the
show. Well, we have the props.
It moved me very,
you know,
very
we have
deeply.
The old Sears catalog and the old toys and the things. So you see a lot of people who grew up on a farm with their grandchildren or children, and they'll point things out on the stage and say, we used to have this, or yes, this was a Sears catalog that I remember. And so that's a real gift to myself. That's a very selfish thing I do.
It's incredible. The picture is actually the picture of his aunt, isn't it?
It's a copy of the actual photograph. There was only one made of them together. And he writes about his last Christmas with this elderly cousin, who we assume through the writing is retarded. And there during the Great Depression in Alabama, and how they fashioned their own ornaments and cut their own tree, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful story.
And made their own presents of, yes. of and they she cooked for people and
fruitcakes.
Yeah. Yes.
It's almost like poetry. I mean, in a very sense, he chose a certain rhythm, a certain pentameter, a certain language to be completely glued to your emotion.
Yes.
I mean, it never went away from that.
We should mention for our listeners' knowledge that David doesn't do the Truman Capote voice in the performance. He uses his own voice, yes.
thankfully,
which works. Yes. Well, I don't know. I you know, it could be seen either way. I mean, but it does certainly come off tremendously powerfully the way it's done. But I have to say, your voice is very convincing, what you were just doing with Truman.
I think you've definitely got his voice down.
Yeah.
So bouncing from that to, can you turn me up a little bit? I'm. Oh, is it me?
You can turn yourself up. There we go. This is auto.
Turning myself
on.
Is this too loud? Am I too loud in your headset?
No, you're fine.
We got the auto audio stimulation thing going here.
Sorry. I'm fiddling with my own voice. Here we go.
Is this something like playing with yourself?
Be quiet. Back to your room. Who invited you out? So, and the most recent production you did, which I wanted to come to and completely forgot about time, was Br'er Rabbit. I mean,
Briar Patch.
Briar Patch.
Mm-hmm. It's based on the Joel Chandler Harris stories. And so it's Br'er Rabbit, Br'er Fox, Br'er Bear. We opened this in 1976 when Vice President Mondale came to Raleigh. And we premiered it for him. Actually, it was done for the Jefferson Jackson Day dinner, where you have about 5,000 Democrats eating barbecue.
Oh, boy.
Right.
So my instruction to the cast before we went on was to make 5,000 Democrats put their forks down and listen. I said, if you can do this, we got a hit.
Yeah, really.
And they managed. He really enjoyed it. In fact, when I got off the stage, there were two Secret Service agents. And they just grabbed me under my arm.
Oh,
my
no.
feet didn't even. And I said, "Oh, that's it. I'm
in trouble now."
But
it's a hell of a way to tell me they didn't like the show.
Yeah, I mean, and they don't. You ask them questions, they don't respond.
No.
I mean, so they carried me back behind the dais, and he came out a couple of seconds later, and he just said, "I want to shake your hand." He said, "I've seen a bunch of these things. You know, we have to go to all these things." He said, "I was really entertained." He said, "My wife's at Kennedy Center. You want to take this thing to Kennedy Center, just get in touch, and we'll get you up there."
Wow.
And we couldn't, because, number one, we didn't have the money, and number two, yeah. we had our season, and we were underway. So,
well, I'd say you could easily take A Christmas Carol to Kennedy Center out pretty much any way you wanted to. It qualifies as much of for a Broadway production as anything I've ever seen, and I worked Phantom of the Opera.
Well, it's grown into quite a show, and we have new scenery from, Blue Cross Blue Shield gave us $125,000.
Wow.
Which we invested in Broadway's quality scenery. Mark Parolo from Winston-Salem designed it. School of the Art students painted it and constructed
Fantastic.
It. And so it's a tremendous show. I mean, just physically, we have two semi-trucks now that we pack it up in.
Where do you store it?
We have an off-site storage facility in Garner.
And, I see.
We haul it over there every year, and that's going to be the challenge in terms of getting the show to France, because we've got a lot of stuff to take. 20 years ago it was a lot easier going through customs.
What do you do, ship it ahead of time or something?
We would have to
ship.
Oh yeah, you'd have
to. Costumes and everything, but then of course it would have to come back immediately because we would open in Durham.
Ouch,
and then
yes.
the Raleigh run, so we're trying to work all of that out.
Are the storage boxes, are they container cargo?
Yes.
Types?
So yes, built to be.
That makes it a little easier.
It does. They were built to travel.
It's still expensive to ship
two
containers. Yeah.
And then, of course, you're also talking about, I think I heard Adam mention that, Adam Twist said that you're going to be launching it this year, and I don't know if I've misunderstood, at the new entertainment center in Durham.
Durham, yes. The new, the brand new theater, which is absolutely gorgeous. Durham's very lucky to have it. It's in a beautiful location right between the ballpark and the new specialty shops.
Mm-hmm. Seats so, 2,600 or 2,800, somewhere around there.
900 in the second balcony. There are three balconies.
Wow.
I mean, it's really incredible. They've designed it. Of course, it sits near the railroad track, so they've soundproofed that end of the building. green rooms. Of course, the actor, you're going to go backstage and look and see what the dressing rooms are like and what the green room is like.
No doubt, yeah.
Because the front can look beautiful, and then they can really scrimp on the...
What about the comfort zones?
Yes. But they've done a beautiful job, and I think Durham should be rightly proud of this
thing.
And then, of course, they'll get all the Nederlander shows. The big Broadway musicals will come there. And so folks will be coming from miles around to see some...
I would hope, because there's a big question in Durham in itself as to whether or not it's going to be able to sustain the kind of economy.
Yeah. And so that's just a few blocks from the Carolina Theater, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Close by.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet.
I've been invited to go, and I think it's happening on... the invitation is for December 1st.
We know anybody who's working there?
Yeah, I know quite a few folks.
Who do we know?
I don't know that you do, but I can't think of any names right now, but I know I got the invitation from Betty and Cora at the Carolina Theater, the people in charge of volunteerism, and also the president's secretary. So I plan to go. I think it's December
1st. Yeah, I'm going to go down there and check it out.
Well, we're excited. We're going to be the first big show in there, so we can't wait to see.
What are those dates?
Flip a switch and the water comes on. That's because, you know, you're going to have to work out a few bugs.
Yeah.
It's the first weekend in December.
Is that when you're going to be there? Christmas Carol?
Yes.
That's an excellent time to be there, I think. Yeah.
And we'll close on the Sunday in Durham and literally strike... pack the trucks and drive to Raleigh and load in on Monday morning in Raleigh.
At Memorial or Progress Energy. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And then when is France?
France will be around Thanksgiving next year.
Ah, okay. So it's a separate time.
Yes.
I was wondering about that shuffle.
So that'll give us a little time off once we come back from France. We went over in July and saw the theater again and met our old friends who were there 20 years ago when we went.
Oh, my God.
It was really... quite phenomenal. You could walk down the street in Compiègne. It was Compiègne, the forest of Compiègne, is where Hitler had the railroad car brought back for the surrender. France's surrender to Germany in World War II. And then he got in his limousine and was driven to a hill overlooking Compiègne and said, "Burn it." And they leveled it. But they rebuilt it, and it's still incredibly beautiful. But when we would walk down the streets in our jackets or sweatshirts that had the Christmas Carol logo, the emblem on it, people would come out of stores with bottles of wine and cheese and bread and just hand them to you.
Oh, wonderful.
And just say, "We're so happy and glad that you're here." The shop fronts were decorated with North Carolina flags.
Oh, my gosh.
They couldn't have been kinder and any more enthusiastic. So
amazing.
We were very, very fortunate. The same thing we encountered in England with our sister city in England, Kingston-upon-Hull. Mm-hmm. There's a tremendous interest in Raleigh, in this area, in the Triangle area. And you come back and you try to tell the local newspapers, "Hey, you know, you ought to carry something about our sister cities. You would share some news," because when people travel abroad, if they went to these places and people found out they were from Raleigh, they would be just welcomed. They roll out the red carpet.
Has there been any press in advance of what's going to happen next year with you going to France?
I think we've announced it, but not a lot of press. And that'll really start up, I think, you know, closer to the tour date next year.
This would be the time for him to start talking about it, I would think.
Get
it well in advance. And
well, again, we'll have a website, and you'll be able to go onto the Theater in the Park website, and which is www.theaterinthepark.com, but we do spell it with an R-E,
you know,
not E-R.
Yeah, okay, good.
I had to go to School of the Arts 5 years just to learn how not to say theater.
Theater. We're all going to the theater.
What is a the and why does it keep eating her?
Yes, that was the first thing I did. I said, "Okay, we're going to spell it with an R-E now."
Yes. Well, I think there'd be tremendous interest here in Chapel Hill Carborough about the...
In Chapel Carborough? You get yours straight, mister.
That's how we call it around here. Chapel Carborough. There'd be a lot of interest here, I would think, in the trip to France.
Well, we're taking folks with us, and we'll have a special package deal. So people who want to go and spend about a week, and you haven't lived until you see how the French prepare Thanksgiving.
I can imagine that.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Because they said, "What do you eat? What do you have?" Yeah. And we said, "Well, turkey, cranberry sauce, dressing, and...
I didn't realize it was the same thing. I thought it was goose or something.
Well, that's what we told them, and what we got was, of course, the French version of Claudio, course. Which you would appreciate being such a fine chef, but the food was exquisite, but not exactly like we prepared it.
Uh-huh,
it was
no
their
doubt.
best attempt, which was wonderful.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
No doubt. Now, it wouldn't be right for me to have you in the studio without at least mentioning Evan Rachel with your daughter.
Yes.
What's she up to these days?
She just finished a Woody Allen a movie in New York and really enjoyed that.
Not yet released.
It was simply referred to as Woody's Summer Project, and that's
interesting.
They adore that man in New York. My wife and I went up to see Evan, and of course he can just show up on a street corner, set up cameras, and they let him do it. And you're suddenly in his movie if you're walking down a sidewalk.
And he's such a small, skinny gestalt. But
he is. Oddly enough, Woody's line producer for many years was my son's was godfather to my son. His name was Jack Grossberg, and he's passed away.
How about your son's name?
Ira David the Fourth.
There we go.
Yes, I did mention to Woody that Jack had told us so many incredible stories of being on location with Woody, and one I'll share with you. Jack was an incredible practical joker, and you know Woody plays in this jazz group, and he had his clarinet that he would bring onto the set, and in between setups, he might sit in over in a corner and blow it a bit and play a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So Jack sent one of the grips to a pawn shop and bought a clarinet. And while Woody was watching a scene, he switched Woody's clarinet with his clarinet from the pawn shop.
Oh, no.
And Woody came back, and they were talking about something, and Jack was getting animated, but he started swatting an imaginary fly that was buzzing around, and finally got exasperated and reached over and picked up the clarinet and just busted it against this tree. Woody almost had a heart attack. I mean, but that was Jack. So when I mentioned Jack to Woody, he said, "My God, you know," he said, "you know, we could make a movie about that man," which was true. He's a wonderful guy. But Evan's got, Warren Beatty just invited her over to talk about a movie he wanted to do with her. And I said, "How was that, meeting Warren Beatty?" And she said, "You will not believe this, Dad." She said, "I sat with that man for 10 hours.
Oh, my God.
Listening to Hollywood stories."
I can imagine he's got them all.
Because he was there right at the cusp when the studios were still in control.
That's right. Yeah.
And as she said, "I didn't want to leave."
Was Annette Bening there, I would assume?
No, this was at his office.
Oh,
and
I see.
He had actually asked Evan to come in for a meet and greet, and then another actor that he was interested in for the movie. And he told Evan, he said, "Just tell me to shut up, but I'll just keep telling stories as long as you want to hear them." And she said, "Just keep going."
I wish she'd had a tape recorder, my God.
I know. I said, "Well, that's like taking a film history course in Hollywood."
Yeah, it would be.
Then she
he was dubbed Mr. Hollywood at one time.
Oh, yeah.
From the old school.
Yeah, knew a good many people in Hollywood, in the biblical sense, too.
Oh, that I can believe,
Like a tsunami.
He was kind of the golden child, in a sense.
Yes, and shared some of those stories, which I don't think I can repeat to Evan, but she did enjoy them. Then she's going to go to Louisiana and make a movie with Jodie Foster, and for this she has to go to trapeze school for 2 months and learn how to be a daring young lady on the flying trapeze.
Goodness.
Cool.
It's a love story about a trapeze artist in Louisiana in a little circus in 1940, and she falls in love with the wolf boy in the circus. So it's a Beauty and the Beast story, it sounds like. But she's real excited about learning how to be a trapeze artist.
Well, she's a great romantic image anyway.
Yes.
So I can see her falling into that. So anyway, Evan, if you remember your once known as Uncle Claudio bouncing you on his knee from many moons ago at your dad's parties.
Yes.
Just a big hello and a shout out that you're amazing. Just had to pull that plug there.
Oh, yes. Well, she's doing very well. Julie Taymor has talked to her, too, about coming and doing Spider-Man on Broadway. Julie's going to be directing a new musical. Bono has done the music.
Wow. Which version will this be? The initial one or an overall mix?
This is a mix. I think the villains are women. Black Widow spider, that kind of thing.
See that.
And you know, Julie did...
Sexy and scary.
Yes, yes. And of course, Julie did Lion King, and her visualization of that was incredible. So I can't imagine what the special effects will be in this Broadway show. But Evan really loved working with her in the musical movie Across the Universe.
I saw that not too long ago.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing as well.
The thing I was amazed at was that all the singing is live. That's not canned.
Evan said, I didn't know that.
If they started shooting at 6 a.m. in the morning, they had to be ready, warmed up.
To sing.
Because they were singing live.
That's tough.
Yeah.
I need to watch it again now just to
really,
make note of that.
Yeah. And it was a strange feeling, having lived through the 60s, to see your daughter as a, you know, flower child.
I can imagine. God knows.
I said, you made me feel young and old at the same time.
Yes. Strange dichotomy. I kept going inside out.
Yes. Well, I told her, I said, you know, I lived in some of those apartments that I saw in the movie. I said, I knew those.
Oh, wow.
Yes, you know, the posters, the psychedelic things. I mean, all of that. I remember so well. And to see her suddenly transported back into that era was a very strange sensation.
It just sort of makes you realize that how little control we have of who we bring into this world and what they can evolve.
So like Gibran said, we fire the arrow from the bow. We don't know where it's going to go or land.
We are the living arrows from which our children are sent. We are the bow from which our children are sent forth as living arrows.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's incredible. Oh, speaking of that, I was watching an Arthur Conan Doyle, the actual original film they made of The Lost World, which was actually quite good.
It is.
And there was a line in there that I just had, I captured and I heard and I just had to write down. It's where one of the scientists says to another who has a very difficult time with believing in God because he believes in science. And the statement that is made, and I can't remember the actor's name now, is, I don't know that there is a God, but I do know that man is no substitute if there isn't. I couldn't resist.
Love that. Amen to that.
That's
for sure.
Terrific. That's great.
And that goes for Woe Man, too.
So. Yes, yes.
Let's get the picture clear. So where should we branch from Evan? Obviously, every time I turn around, she's in a new picture.
She is. She's an incredible actress. I predict, and I've said this, but it's dad talking, but I think it's based on, you know, a lot of fact. She's going to have an Academy.
There's some genetics at play in this as well.
Well,
but I never realized, knowing her as a child, that she was even given that direction.
Well, she grew up in the theater. She and her brother both. I mean, the prop room was their toy box.
Ah, I see. Okay. Things I didn't see when I came to visit you.
I would walk out into the theater, and she'd be sitting on the stage, and she'd be making up a monologue, her own monologue.
Wow.
So when you see that at an early age, you kind of go, okay, they are to the manner born.
Right. Did you by chance capture any of this on film?
I did.
Oh,
actually, I have some video tucked away one day. I'll have to bring it out and show her.
I'd love to see it.
Yeah, she's doing great. And my son, Ira, who's been out there as well.
You have him co-directing with you now in Christmas Carol.
He will be co-directing this year, and so great to have him. He's 22. He got all the looks. I mean, he has legs and pecs. And
stature.
I've always been. I had a Scrooge body from the time I was a teenager. If I turned sideways in gym class, they marked me absent. You know? So he got all of the muscles and the looks, and I'm really thankful to have him back. Evan will be back for the holidays, and so that's always a great time just to.
Now, is he still living locally, or is he also out there?
He's out there in California as well, and he's done some movie work too. I think his big break will come. I think in many ways he's as talented as Evan,
mm-hmm.
but it's just a matter of being in the right place at the right time.
Is he influenced in a different direction, or is he also more in acting than directing?
He's interested in directing, but he's writing a lot, and he's very interested in that end of it. So that's also exciting because I'm doing a lot of writing too, and sitting up and burning the midnight oil and mm-hmm. talking about things is always fun.
What are you working on, if you don't mind me asking?
This has been a really creative burst for me. I just finished a play called Dark Glass, which is
one that you wrote.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's I had an actor in my Dennis Hopper.
Okay.
And also Tommy Lee Jones. When I write, I try to picture people. So
I do that sometimes.
Two guys out. And the play is about an astronaut who has walked on the moon, gone to the moon and back.
Mm-hmm.
And he's middle-aged now, and, you know, 60s, 70s, and he's having a nervous breakdown. So they put him in a government facility, and they have this woman who's a psychiatrist who's helping him work through this breakdown. But he is coming to believe more and more that he did not go to the moon. And so they bring in his two other astronauts, his friends who went with him, and to see if they can't bring him around. And there happens to be a guy from the NSA there, National Security Agency. And they begin to question why this guy is there. Right? What's he doing here? And you get into the whole thing about did we go, didn't we go, what actually happened. And as the three astronauts get together and talk, they begin to realize that all three of them have some commonalities. They're these small little memory blanks, and they can't recall
interesting
certain things.
I can see you playing that one up.
So it was a lot of fun to write. Then, of course, I had to start working on one about the Kennedy assassination, and there again,
what's your title on this one, or even if it's a working title?
Dark Quadrant.
Quadrant. Dark, like has, dark, thing,
dark has come into
dark
this.
Dark is in
yes,
there.
Is in there. Well,
I like that, though. Quadrant.
But I said, you know, a movie that I would love to see would be with Sean Connery and Mel Gibson. So I started the novel, and the novel basically is about two assassins, and Connery being, of course, the number one assassin in the world, and Gibson being the up-and-comer. And they're both offered contracts to kill Kennedy. And Connery declines, of course, because he realizes that what they're going to do is off the shooters. And that's an unspoken code. You don't shoot the shooters. So he and the Gibson character align and decide they're going to try to prevent the assassination of Kennedy.
Fantastic.
Of course, we know how it turns out, but you know, it's still following it, and I'm having a grand time writing it. And then the second novel I'm working on is about the Second Coming.
But then they were switching subject matter.
Yes. So you see, depending on what mood you are late at night, could work on one or the other. But it's basically a story about a man's search for his faith, to rediscover his faith again in the 21st century. And he's a writer, he's a reporter, and he and his wife are traveling to the cemetery in Normandy, Saint-Laurent-sur-Mer.
What a great image.
Where actually they filmed the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan. But
yes.
my uncle is buried there. That's how
I am
familiar with it. And I rented a car once in Paris and rode to meet him. I always said I was meeting him.
Is your uncle buried there as a result of the war?
Yes, he died in D-Day.
Gotcha.
And no one in my family ever got to visit the grave. My father died before he could get back over. He was 42 when he died, so he was young.
Terribly young.
Was he landing on the shore, or was he dropped?
Landing. Okay. Landing, and moved in, was moving inland, leading his platoon of men. He was first lieutenant, and stepped on a landmine.
Oh, God.
He lost his legs below the knees, and it was actually recovering when a blood clot washed off and took him out immediately.
Oh, yeah.
So it was a tremendous loss. And that cemetery, by the way, 10,000 graves. And when you walk into it, and I've traveled, you know, a lot. Nothing I've seen, from the Great Wall, the Forbidden City, Notre Dame, the Hindu Kush Mountains, nothing affected me like the cemetery.
How come?
Is it
the visual aspect or just sensing?
It's something there. I think because my uncle was buried there, but you don't see it until you walk through this building and then out the side door. And it's immaculate. And of course, it's United States territory. It belongs to us, and that you're in on American soil when you're there.
And 10,000 graves—that's huge.
It's amazing. Well, all I could think about was it was twice the population of my hometown in Eastern North Carolina, where I grew up.
Yeah. Which is
Enfield, North Carolina, in Halifax County. But if you look at every cross, every Star of David, and then you realize there's a mother and a father grieving, and a sister, a brother, a wife, a husband. And the grief becomes so magnified that I tell you, it's such a statement against war. you're overlooking you're right on the beach, Omaha Beach, where they came up. So we spent about an hour and a half there. And then I said, let's walk down to the beach and just sit here for a minute and blow the cobwebs out before we drive 3 hours back to Paris. So as we were walking down to the beach, this strikingly beautiful middle-aged lady was coming up from the beach, and immediately it was obvious she was topless. And which, you know,
hello,
North Carolina, yes, you just stop for a minute and take in the natural beauty of it all.
Indeed.
And then I realized, well, of course, this is France. And so as we went down there, here were these beautiful women cavorting in the waves, these little naked French children running along the beach, flying kites. And I sat there and I thought to myself, my God, you know, if these guys had to lay down the ultimate sacrifice, this was what it's for.
Absolutely.
And I look back on the ridge. I look back behind me on the ridge, and I said, you know, those GIs are standing up there right now, whistling and catcalling and going, yeah, this is it. Because, and you sit there and you imagine, what would this place be like or have been like had the war turned out differently?
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. You know, and you sit there and try to imagine that, and it's amazing. But anyway, I digressed.
No. I think that's the full spectrum of the picture there. No,
the husband and wife in the novel are traveling to this beach, and they round a corner in the road, and there's a herd of cattle that kind of drifted out on the road. So they're in an accident,
mm-hmm.
and the woman is thrown from the car. His wife is thrown from the car, and he lands about 30 feet away.
And how's the cow?
We don't know. I didn't write about cows.
We don't get into the beasts.
Yes. But she's dead. I mean, he looks at her, and she's not breathing, and he's got compound fractures, and he's losing consciousness. He knows he's going to bleed to death. And he looks up, and out of this field of sunflowers, because that was another thing that amazed me when we made the trip, was that acres and acres of sunflowers, this 13-year-old boy comes walking through the flowers, and he's kind of dark complected with the curly hair and the dark brown eyes, and he doesn't speak, but he goes over to the man who's lying on the ground, and he places his hand on his chest, and the man feels this sensation of peace and just feels this light, and the boy gets up and goes over to his wife about 30 feet away and kneels down by her, and the man is looking, and the boy's back is to him, but the man imagines that he sees this burst of light and hears her take a breath. And the boy gets up and kind of looks back at him and smiles, never speaks, and walks away. And that's the way the book starts.
Oh, wonderful. Neat.
So it turns out that, of course, this is where we left Jesus. This is where we left Christ in the Bible. 13, and then he disappears and comes back and in his 30s. Mm. So I said, well, we're going to pick him up here.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he's been cloned from the Shroud of Turin. They have managed to clone. So the two brothers, there are two brothers who are, you know, these scientists who cloned him.
These CSIs and their DNA.
Yeah, and they've isolated the DNA, and they've matched it to another holy relic, which is also in Italy, and they've decided whoever the man is who was buried in the shroud, they've recreated him, and he's back.
And this was the personification of the boy?
Right, and that's who the boy
Incredible.
Is. So the scientists begin to die mysteriously, and, you know, there's some violent force out there. And, you know, the whole idea is, if you clone the man in the shroud, do you clone whatever powers
everything else
that comes with it?
Does the soul inhabit that space?
Yes, exactly. So, again, I have no idea where I'll... Where
that's the beauty of writing. You never know where it's going to go.
It's wonderful. Yeah. There's a new young pope, and I think there will be a final meeting between the young boy who's eventually brought to New York,
and again from geography.
A personal experience. Again, when I go to New York, I love St. Bart's. And there is a sidewalk cafe right next to St. Bart's. I go to. Every Sunday I'm in New York and sit and have a sangria and watch people. It's just wonderful. But I will go over to St. Bart's and go inside. Well, always in the churches, in the cathedrals. You see these effigies and the statues, and I just kept thinking to myself, my God, what would it be like for that young boy to walk in and see himself? You know, and would we create or recreate the same? Would he be greeted the same way? Would the end be the same that it was before, as it tends to be with so many prophets? You know, we don't receive them very well. So I'm just having a wonderful time with that. And
actually, it's making me think of some aspects of my piece, The Crown of Thorns.
Ah,
a little boy on the beach.
See,
meeting Christ, and but then again, it going on leaving a mystery.
Well, there was a poem when I was growing up, and I thought it was haunting, and I can just remember the first part of it, but it was, if Jesus came to my house and knocked upon the door, I'm sure I'd be more happy than I've ever been before. I'd run downstairs to greet him, the door I'd open wide, and then I'd say to Jesus, won't you please, sir, come inside? And I've used that, and I just thought, you know, what if we could sit and talk? And then, of course, as you know, when you're writing, you get into all this kind of research. You find out that he did leave, because the next time we see Jesus in the Bible, he's paying what was known as a stranger's tax. That meant he was out of the country. And there's one theory that is absolutely amazing to me, is that Joseph of Arimathea, who, of course, offered the tomb and the land that historic Jesus was supposedly buried in, was Jesus's uncle, and he was equivalent to, say, Aristotle Onassis.
Interesting. Okay.
So when Joseph, Jesus's father, died, we think when he was 14, it's possible that the uncle, Joseph of Arimathea, took this young boy and put him on boats, and he traveled. Mm-hmm. So he could very well have gone to Egypt. He could very well have gone to Britain.
India is also speculation.
India also. So it's amazing, you know, because again, that's what it brought out in the book. You have questions, you go to a minister, you're sent back to the Bible. Mm-hmm. It's very rarely they give you space to go and read and learn outside, but then you have to say to yourself, well, look, if there was a man supposedly crucified and resurrected, wouldn't there be historical records?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are letters, and the research is fascinating.
Yeah, the letter's not contemporaneous.
It's just,
where did you find that word?
Well, in fact, there is no contemporaneously written history of Jesus in the era. The nearest period of any mention of him whatsoever that is itself sort of dubious is about 70 years hence.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the stuff that's credited for being historical is anywhere from 150 to 300 years later.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But Pilate did write letters to Rome, because he had to report. And the interesting thing was that Nero he was suffering from gout, Caesar.
Right.
So he wants this healer sent to Rome to cure him of his gout. So he's really ticked off at Pilate for having executed him.
There are some scholars who have debunked that, saying that those sections are actually written much later, because of the style and everything.
They're written later, but again, it's like every fable. Is there?
There's got to be something. There's got to be something to it.
Yeah. I just find it infinitely interesting to try to look for answers in places that you're sometimes told not to look.
Well, I see it I won't belabor this, but I see it as a continuity of an archetype more than anything else. And I think that has as great a meaning as it would if we had videos of Jesus, you know.
Absolutely.
Certainly, any way you want to look at it, the influence is such an enlightening and positive force that it deserves all credibility.
Absolutely. And of course, writing is history, you have to start from the resurrection. Because as we know, his birth was not a sellout.
No.
You know, there were three wise men and a few shepherds. That's not a full house.
There was standing room only, but only because there were no chairs.
And we haven't heard about the wise guys.
Yes. But I do think that we are due for a revolution
in religion. I think in the 21st century, we're going to see something that is going to move and shake.
We're way overdue.
Well, organized religion as we know it to its core. Yeah.
Speaking with my own family, we know that the churches are barely running in Europe.
Yeah.
Because the youth of today does not support it. They even decline the tax that is imposed on them to sustain these churches, because otherwise they couldn't sustain them. So there's a big walk away from the church itself.
Well, too, and any time you have a vacuum like that, something is going to fall into it with such force.
Very true.
That it's going to reverberate.
Isn't that what Sarah Palin's all about?
And here we go. We're back on the rail. The roller coaster is now going down.
Down. We just plunged.
But we might as well jump over there, because I do think that was part of our intent today. David is rather expert at the news of the current news, anyway, of the Kennedy assassination, and has done some work on that himself. And I've always been curious about what you might have to point out currently now. You were telling me about a book that has just been written that you found fascination
yes,
with.
JFK and the Unspeakable. It's an extraordinary book, and it puts his life and, again, his death into a perspective that is rare when you read about the assassination. I do think that November 22nd, 1963, was when, to a great degree, this nation's trust in its government began its downward spiral. And I don't think we've recovered from that afternoon in Dallas, Texas.
And yet the same powers of governance are still in effect.
Are still there.
Which is what baffles the mind.
And even more entrenched. And whereas was basically, if you accept the fact that it was a conspiracy and assassination, I do. I'm one who does.
I certainly do.
I think there's no doubt about it. I just don't see how you can come to any other conclusion.
Mm. Well, people have, obviously, have written tomes about the fact that it was one man. But then you have to, it's just that quote from Shakespeare, then all of the elements must have combined against him. Because it's incredible. I mean, how many circumstances were just accidental? I mean, you've got the microphone in the motorcade that goes off, or actually,
it's
quote,
stuck
is stuck.
On. Yes.
Just before the shots have fired.
Indeed.
At the same time, all the power in the Texas School Book Depository goes out.
Yes.
There's no phone, there's no electricity.
You have the bodyguards removed.
Yes. And at the same time, communications in Air Force One go dead. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you look at that and you say, well, yes, it could happen. All of those things could have aligned and happened. But the fact that they happened at precisely that period of time just strains credibility to think that this was accidental.
If that doesn't smell of inside job, then pass me the cheese.
Oh, really? I mean, and the fact that the security was different in Dallas than it was even the day before.
Indeed.
And scaling back, again, as you said, the motorcycle escorts, which normally rode right up next to Kennedy on the side of the car.
To take the bullet.
Yeah. And they were pushed back. There is also, if you Google it, you can Google Secret Service agent stand down.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And it's amazing, because as Kennedy gets in the limousine with Conley and the Greer and Kellerman, the driver, and he's leaving Love Field, two Secret Service agents literally head to the rear of his car to stand on the bumper that was especially made, and they had hand grips. And they're called down by the head of the Secret Service detail.
From the car right behind.
He stands up in the car and waves them off. And you can see, they're very frustrated. They don't know what the hell is happening.
You can see this in their pantomime and gesture.
Yes.
They don't even have to speak a language.
And they were left at the airport. They didn't join the motorcade. And then, of course, you do have the Secret Service agents who made multiple appearances in Dealey Plaza.
Yep.
And we know now there were no Secret Service agents assigned to Dealey Plaza, but we see them popping up all over the place. So you begin to add so many of these things. I started, again, wanting to write a play about it because it was such a watershed event. I remember sitting in French class and the principal coming to the door and making the announcement, and how the floor seemed to just open up. I mean, you could not imagine. But the first thing I heard after the announcement was a remark that they finally got the inward loving SOB. And that was the first thing from a friend of mine sitting next to me. reminded me that a lot of people, particularly in the South, disliked Kennedy a great deal. Now, of course, after he was killed, you couldn't find one person that ever said they didn't like him. I mean, that happened overnight.
Yeah, because the South has always been given to republicanism, and he was, of course.
Well,
a Democrat.
I was in science class in the 10th grade, and came over the school PA, and we didn't have anybody make any negative comments that time. It was quite traumatic for everybody. We pretty much to a person in my school in Inglewood High School, Jacksonville, Florida. People were really quite sad and devastated by it, really, for the most part.
I can imagine. Well, even hearing about it in South Africa, it was amazing the effect it took.
And I remember when they first started talking about the headshot, where they said, "Well, the head of the president jerked back." Which was a natural reaction, they said, and I'm using my fingers in quotes, saying that was a natural muscular nervous reaction, the head popping back. So I went to my father, who killed lots of people in World War II, and asked him about it. And, he said, well, that's just ridiculous. You know, your head goes in the opposite direction from which the projectile is fired.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's why his head would have jerked back.
And now we have a problem, of course, with the Zapruder film, because for years that was supposedly the time clock. I mean, we could watch this film and try to figure out where the shots were fired and where he was positioned on the street. But now there is a theory, and a lot of people hold on to it, that the Zapruder film itself has been doctored and has
missing frames.
I've heard that, yeah.
And if you watch it with that in mind, you will see, for instance, 200 witnesses said the limousine pulled it to the center of Elm Street and stopped.
Came to a stop.
And the headshot was fired at a stationary target.
Right.
Kennedy had two back braces on.
Right.
Which kept him upright in the seat.
Right.
So he was basically a still sitting target.
Yes.
But the Zapruder film does not show the car actually coming to a stop. You can see the brake lights going on. You can see it slowing down.
Which in itself would be an abrogation of the Secret Service rules.
Exactly. Yeah, it was never supposed to go any slower than 40 miles an hour.
Yeah, these people were expertly trained. They never would have slowed down unless they were given orders to do so.
Well, and there's a part in the collected films when Kennedy's limousine turns from Main Street onto Houston, he's facing the book depository. And I watch that, and I see him glance up. And I wonder if for a split second you see you're approaching a tall building with open windows, which supposedly should never have happened.
Yeah. Yes.
And I wonder, and there's a point that he reaches up and strokes his head as he's looking at the building, and you just wonder if you have those, you know, seconds before. Those
premonitions, sort of.
Premonitions of those feelings.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing when Oswald walks out of the police station. You know, in the middle of 70 policemen and cameras, and there is Ruby, and he looks straight at Ruby, and I'll swear, if you watch it, you go back, he knows who the man is.
He knows Jack Ruby.
Yes.
Yeah, he's known him for a while at
he
that point.
He makes eye contact, and he averts his gaze just before Ruby steps in and pulls the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the small things that you do. You go in, and I suppose you could read anything in you wanted to, but he does look at him, and you do see that. You do see Kennedy look up at the book depository.
I think the human radar picks these things up in those moments.
Well, they said Lincoln, sitting in Ford's theater, shivered and adjusted his shawl around his shoulders just before Booth stepped in and fired him. And Kennedy talked a lot about his own death in the days just preceding the assassination. And in fact, in the hotel that morning, he said, last night would have been a perfect time to kill the president. Somebody could have stepped out of the crowd with a gun, fired it, dropped it, and melted away in the crowd.
And similarly, Martin Luther King.
Exactly.
Preempting it.
Pay attention to those things when people have those feelings.
Indeed.
Looks like we're coming closer to the edge of our time here. I did want David to play something in memory of a situation that has not been completely healed yet, and that is Katrina and New Orleans. And I'd like to dedicate this particular recital with a musical accompaniment of Jim Beckwith. The piece is called Blue Whirlwind. or actually it's on the CD called Blue Whirlwind. The piece is called Mud in Your Eye. And I just wanted David to hear this and also to use this as one of our exit pieces. We'll come back on.
Which cut is it?
That's the first one. First one on that. I don't know if David's ever heard this. This is something I just recently did with Jim Beckwith, recorded here in Chapel Hill.
I haven't. I look forward to it.
Okay.
And we are getting ready to go there. This is my version of the Unmedia coming at you. Mud in Your Eye. I've been keeping abreast of the storm's raging quest from a bar in the French Quarter of town, while the gales from the west were all doing their best to hail the apocalyptic Katrina aground. Now there's mud in the eye of the sailor tonight, where broken levees have leveled the shore. And with the warnings all out and the natives in flight, the Big Easy ain't easy no more. When the waters rose as high as an elephant's eye, and knives of wind ceased their cutting about, an eerie silence would sigh as the night gave a cry to the voodoo of time running out. All the souls in despair who felt abandoned by care, and whom misfortune did not allow to depart, questioned country and state in this quagmire of fate, and found it best a debatable heart. A generosity grew from much more than a few who accomplished what politicians could not. But before this was true, an unrest would ensue among the ravaged whom time had forgot. A dead body neglect from the governing sect is the talk of all our daily news. With rivers as streets and all disquieting feats, New Orleans is neck deep in her blues. It's a primitive take when your town is a lake, not to mention the neighboring states. There are strange things afloat in a hat and a coat, all abandoned to partisan traits. At Johnny White's on Bourbon Street, we drank warm beer and spooned canned meat, while Lake Pontchartrain cut a brand new loop and turned a cultural gumbo into toxic soup. It was helter-skelter in a stadium for shelter, where Americans were called refugees. They arrived in great number from a wind that drew thunder and took comfort where there was no aim to please. With a sailboat for a penthouse that drowned out the church mouse, the hurricane blew in some very sad ends. We paid for our choices with ever-weakening voices, resting far too easy on political trends. A government of the rich is a cancerous itch, and reminder that we have all sinned. Like Bob Dylan would say with his nomadic sway, the answer is blowing in the wind. A president touting religion as a special interest stool pigeon may be facing a rising of tides. Ceasing arrogance not, he may soon face his lot, in whom true power and justice resides. Chaos and creation, known as civilization, are subject to a shifting imbalance ashore. A maligned collective neglect always leads to regret. And the Big Easy ain't easy. And that was Mud in Your Eye, with the accompaniment of Jim Beckwith. And David, I wanted to let you know that this is now part of Seafarers. So one of these days, I'm hoping you'll take Seafarers under your wing, and we can stage it again where it was born.
Yes, I'd love that.
By the way, whatever happened to Marty Barletta? I have no idea where she is or what's become of her.
I do not know. Either they come in our lives and they...
That's amazing, because she is essentially how I met you and how Seafarers was staged. And then,
wonderful actress. That sounds very Brechtian to me. It was very nice.
There's a bit
very
of that nice influence in
there.
Sure.
That's outstanding.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I was hoping to put that as a seed in your mind for the eventual Seafarers. And I'd love it if you'd consider doing Seafarers with me. I mean, you and I. doing the piece. We talked about doing some maritime work together.
Yes.
You were thinking of the Outer Banks, and
yes,
I'm open to that.
Yes.
But the idea of both of us, you selecting works you'd like to do, me selecting works I'd like to do, and both of us doing them on stage.
Oh, I wouldn't have to select any. You have a mountain of works now. I mean, yes.
Somehow you could select the pieces you liked.
Yeah, I think that would be wonderful. I'd love it.
So please put that on the back burner.
I shall.
You have heard it on the Speakeasy.
Yes.
Did I mention that this is WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboroughs, which is your community radio station?
And I'd like to thank Ira David Wood III for being so generous as to show up here today, David. And let's consider this a continuing dialogue.
Would love it.
Dialogue.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you for tuning in, folks. This is The Speakeasy. Claudio signing off. Until next time, cheers.
Once again, a chill night wind blows its gales across the sea. As the sunset casts an inflamed and rippled hue across the waters. Vast distances of liquid motion stretch their infinity before me. And I have rarely felt so free. The sails are drawn for a night of rest. Where I go from here, the sea knows best. As the veils of night descend upon me, the moon emits its silvery canvas against a spectacle of aquatic celebration, as is only seen by night. The stars are scattered worlds of light against an opaque sky, and the nightfall is a constant whisper of the mysteries around me. Truly, all description would defy the beauty I choose herein to proclaim. Yet still, though encompassed by more wonder than many a man has e'er freed his soul to admire, my thoughts are adrift with the song of my heart, and the song of my heart with the voice of my soul. Adrift, 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 drifting ever back to you.